home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Coming to you live from Hollywood, it's Rated G Radio with your host, Garrett Miller.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to the show. It's Rated G Radio. I'm your host, Garrett Miller. For the next hour, we're going to have an awesome show. We're going to be joined in just a little bit by Gustavo Sainz, and he's the founder of the Human Time Project. He's also a filmmaker. He's been on the show before, but we're going to talk to him like he's never been on the show before because our show has grown by leaps and bounds, and I think the story that he has to share with us today is so important that we really kind of need him to kind of take us from the very beginning of the origins of the project and kind of bring us up to date on what's been going on. By the way, I've got a ton of people that are calling in on the hotline tonight. If you want to ask a question, or if you're Gustavo, you got to press 1 on your keypad so I'll know which line to answer. Otherwise, I just have a bunch of folks that are dialing in to listen from their telephones, which is always very cool. I love it when you listen from your phone. But, you know, if you want to ask a question or talk, you got to, you know, let me know. So we're going to do that. And a big shout out to Tony in New Jersey for his support in promoting the show of late. He was the fine recipient of an autographed Blonde Jesus CD, and he also got an autographed copy of Rutanya Alda's book, The Mommy Dearest Diary, in the mail today. So congratulations, Tony, on the post office delivering that about three days earlier than originally planned. I don't know how to count from the post office. But thanks, Tony, for Rutanya Alda's interview in the book. And I hope you enjoy the CD Blonde Jesus, as we all hope you do. Now, without further ado, as we always like to say, it's my pleasure to welcome Gustavo Sainz to the show. How are you, my friend?
How are you going, Garrett?
It's been crazy insane, but I have a feeling your world is even crazier. It's wonderful to have you back. I was telling everybody before you dialed in, I said, "Well, thank you." I was telling everybody before you dialed in, I said, "You've been on the show before. You've explained this before, but we have like 10 trillion times more listeners now than we did from last year when you were on." So, number one, I want to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule, because you have so much that is going on in your world that you're doing to help others. But number two, for actually sharing what your project with the Human Time Project is doing for the world. So, starting there, just thanks for being here tonight.
Well, thank you very much, Garrett. And first of all, congratulations on your wild success. I've seen that you've been growing your audience by leaps and bounds, so which is no easy feat on these days right now with so much electronic entertainment all over the place. It's even hard to get eyeballs from the experts. So imagine you trying to grab an audience. But thank you very much for the kind words.
It's one of the things that I love to do here on the show, and I'm going to, it's just you and me, Gustavo, and like a trillion other people that are listening live, but for argument's sake, we're just going to pretend it's you and me tonight. I'll tell people all the time, I love it when I have celebrities on, because, there's a lot of guilty pleasure in the fact that I'm talking to somebody who is on this show or that show or this movie or, did this album or whatever. But my favorite shows to do are when I have people that I call them the regular people, or the people that have the story. And you are absolutely a person that has a story. And those are actually, it's wonderful that I have the celebrity on, but I'm telling you a little known secret. Celebrities are great, but they don't really do a whole lot for the ratings or the listeners or whatever, because, they're there because they're publicists. The publicists, say you got to go on the show and promote your project and all that, and that's great. But when I have people like you that are passionate about what they're doing, they'll tell everybody, and their friends tell everybody, because they're all on board on the Human Time Project bandwagon. And this is when we really are able to do some fun things out there and, talk about things that really make a difference in people's lives. So the fact that you are choosing to do this and are so passionate about this is really, I think, a testament to what an incredible person you are, and also the people that are working with you on this. So just my hats, I'm bowing to you right now. And
well,
I promise.
Thank you.
I've had two cups of iced tea this afternoon, so I'm a little ramped up. So I promise I'm going to be quiet and let you talk. But so with that, tell us about yourself and kind of give us the lead up to the Human Time Project and what it is, because it's really, really cool.
Well, thank you very much. Well, It actually really started a while ago. I'm originally from Uruguay, South America. I came here when I was a younger person, so I kind of started dabbling in, like, you know, in entrepreneurship with my father's couple of companies, and then I kind of migrated into writing, and I started into writing scripts and movies, and then suddenly, like, I just kept in and out, and then suddenly my father contracted cancer, so he got a little bit sick, so I just got out of the industry for a little bit and took care of him. But my family, that was like, they were living in Atlanta, and I was from L.A. So in the meantime, sadly, my dad passed away a little while, and then I was going through the middle of projects, and I was thinking, like, you know, I started a small watch company because I was in a very big enthusiast of watch and watch movements and mechanical things, and so I started importing kits from Switzerland, building them together, and selling them here to my small crowd of Orange County fans. People basically, as you can remember, like in 2004, 2005, 2006, Orange County was a fantasy land with all the real estate money going around and everything making so much money. People wanted something different, so I was kind of like their personal hollier, in which I was basically creating small watches for them, and I started a small Swiss watch brand that I started selling. But actually, when I got my first original prototypes from the factory, that was around 2007, 2008, when the market started to crash and people, all their expendable income started to evaporate. So just kind of that kind of fell in the slum, and I had like all these watches that were handling, like, you know, for a year and a half until I was able to sell a couple of them here, give them a couple of my friends as presents and other. But in the meantime, my family was all in Washington, D.C., and my brother-in-law works for the World Bank. So one day I was there visiting him, and I met with this one team, medical team, that actually was going into Thailand, and I was talking to them what they were going to be doing over there, and they were showing me some of these horrid situations that some of these people, these rural clinics ran. I mean, basically these places where people are being attended were actually tents, where people getting their flu shots, measles shots. It was incredible, like, you know, the level of poverty, but these people were going in to try to bring in some aid from the outside, you know. And then among the list of stuff that they need, of course, they need cotton swabs, you know, this type of equipment. Among the list were watches, and I said, really, watches? And the guy was explaining to me, one of the head doctors, said, yeah, of course, because, I mean, when you have a first aid situation, you have to take respiratory pulses, you have to check, like, vitals, you have to do certain type of things. If a kid gets bitten by a poisonous snake, you only have so many hours to treat the anti-venom, otherwise you have to go through another type of different. You have a cardiac arrest, you have to resuscitate and pressure the chest cavity every like 16 or 20 seconds or something like that. So a working watch is a very vital tool for a doctor, which I kind of knew but never really thought to, because here, like in Orange County, we're like, you know, in the middle of, you know, such a privileged area, and sure, watches are just like more of a luxury item than really a tool. And I said, wow, that was a really great idea. And it got me thinking, because I've always been a big fan of Blake Mikofsky and his Tom Shoes movement, which I thought was a brilliant idea. And I thought, poor guy, he's going to get squashed in a couple of years by Adidas and Nike when they find out about that. But then a year passed by, 2 years passed by, 3 years passed by, nothing happened. And then I started digging into the situation. And then, of course, it was very evident. It was pure capitalism. These corporations and these shareholders would never agree in a board meeting to give away 30 to 28% of their earnings for a donation. So this guy basically got saved by greed. And I said, wow, that would be a really great idea if I can kind of bring this concept to, like, you know, to watches, which is, was kind of my passion. And I was looking for something, how I can kind of implement a one-for-one system. So a year kind of went by between I found, like, you know, the right manufacturing company that can bring in, like, you know, the watches at a good quality level. I have talked to a couple organizations. I did a couple of things over there. And I just designed my first model out of nothing. And through the grace of God and, like, God bless the internet, I got the traction of some of these most of these large men's blogs, and they started publishing the idea of the Human Time Project, which kind of, like, blessed the stuff, Cool Material, Gear Patrol, Houdinki, some of the really top guys that kind of, oh, this was kind of an interesting thing, and that kind of proposed me into this, like, you know, this little, like, you know, jump start of a company. And before I know it, I had $20,000 in orders, and I had to get ready to fulfill them. And then, well, a long story short, it's been almost 2 years and a half we've been in business. And only by the sake of social media, and we spend zero money on advertising. Of course, we really can't, because we try to save as much money as we can to keep ourselves functional, but at the same time do donations. And we are happy to say that we've passed the 740 watches donated to medical workers in parts of Central America and other areas. And even though it's a small amount of watches, it's a really great leap for us, in the sense that, like, you know, we're doing it as they come. So we basically create sales, and then every 6-7 months we do a donation here. And we've been working really great with this one organization that's kind of been kind of like our little motor there in Central America. They do a lot of great stuff for Nicaragua, Guatemala mostly, and other countries. It's called Helps International. And we go into these rural clinics, you know, and we go into these places in the mountains where there's this one time Carmen Gandaro, which is kind of like the director of the area there in Guatemala, was telling me that they went to this one hospital in the highlands of Guatemala, which they weren't able, this hospital hasn't been able to make an operation in a year because they didn't have running water. And then when they got in there, just with the first couple of months, the water started flowing again. And they were like backlined. They were like, you know, 120 people waiting for basic operation. So it was like, you know, it was incredible the level of commitment these people were having. So we got in there and we were able to donate a couple of watches here and there to the medical area. So, like I said, it's been going very, very vigorously. But at the same time, publicity has become a more of an issue right now because we're at the verge where either we put in a lot of money to expose ourselves out there, or do we keep it low key to the social media level? But the problem is at the social media level, we've already gone as far as we can. So right now, we've been trying to kind of get the word out there, and that's why I really much everybody likes to thank you and the organization for your kind time to help us express our project out to the many listeners out there, and how it is important that that there can be companies that can do some good. You know, we have Warby Parker, we have Tom's, we have a couple of other companies that basically are creating this old social entrepreneurship that I think is a fabulous idea. Just imagine this crazy idea, Gary. If every single company in the world donated 0.5 of a per 1% of their money to a cause, I think a lot of problems would be solved in a month.
And the thing is, we don't even know how much money that would be because a lot of the companies are private, or even the public companies, by the time they get done, cooking their numbers, it just looks completely different. But if you take that tiny, tiny, minuscule percentage, the quality of life and the lives that it would change if you put that money towards good versus evil would just be staggering.
It would be amazing. But at the same time, capitalism is a great thing, but also like everything else, when it runs amok, it just creates extreme greed. And I've been a capitalist all my life and run under capitalist principles, but the problem is so much you need, there's the point where the rest is just for showing off, So you can have, and I applaud people who have beautiful cars and beautiful yachts and this and that, but do you need the biggest yacht on the planet? Do you need the biggest plane in the world? Do you need the most luxurious, extravagant car in the world? Certain things are great, but when it comes to extremes, it's when I think it's a little bit wasteful. And if there wasn't so much unevenness in the world, that wouldn't stand out. But there is. There's people who wake up every morning and walk 3 to 4 miles to get their water. That is happening right now. There are people in refugee camps who basically don't have a home because of all these wars that are going on with ISIS and all these different terrible situations. And they would be happy just to have a place to go to bed tonight, So
right.
What we're trying to do right now, it just seems so minimal to me, so minuscule, but at the same time, I really love the people are trying to create some sort of solution or a situation or minimal help, that's out there. So, I really applaud people who try to really get their work out there for good,
Well, and, when we talk about what you're doing, it's, you're making these watches for these developing countries and the people that you're helping us. You're working with a particular manufacturer to do this. Now, do you have retail locations also that set up so people go down West Coast Plaza or something like that?
No, actually, that was a very interesting situation because I actually got the opportunity earlier this year to probably go into a couple of Nordstroms to test out systems. But when they explained to me how the whole Nordstrom system worked, it was a little bit complicated for me in the sense that it was way too much money investment for the benefit. For example, I had to upfront all my inventory. I had to basically replace whenever they needed. If I wanted to be featured in the catalog, I don't know if it was $25,000 or $30,000. So all this stuff that I was it was they're Nordstrom and I'm Human Time Project. I'm not Rolex. I'm not Panerai. I'm not Breitling, So
right.
It's a sense that they're saying, hey, you need more of than we need you, So I was thinking that is great. Yeah, that is exposure. But at the same time, I'm going to be just another brand that's in there in their counters with very little exposure out there. I'm not going to be pushed out there. So I figure, if I'm going to upfront the whole inventory and actually spend extra money to be in the catalog. Why don't they just start with a small kiosk at, you know, at Irvine Spectrum and have the word out there myself, you know, and create more of a direct sales, you know, because they're going to be taking their cut, you know, and that's more that the item is going to be marked up to the public. So I figure, well, you know, there was that kind of situation. So I decided kind of like, you know, to kind of hold back this year, reorganize myself and probably start with a couple of small retail places in Orange County, because once I told people about the idea, and if they're ready to buy a watch and they're in the market, people, they should, like, you know, love the idea and purchase, because, I mean, it's a great idea, it's a great concept, and people enjoy the fact that they're helping others, you know.
Well, and then, okay, but when you're doing these watches here, Gustavo, now what's the average price point? Like $7 million a watch? I mean, what does it cost to, you know, help the project and get a watch?
Well, actually, that's one of the situations that we wanted to avoid also when we were first designing the whole system. We wanted a watch that would be good quality, but at the same time affordable to people to help donate. So our price range is between $135 to $170. So it's in a price range where people basically can almost do an impulse buy. When we did our first model a couple of years back, the first watch came out at $98 because I wanted to do like a standout point. But, of course, right now, precious metals have gone up with the fluctuations of gasoline and everything. Steel has gotten a little bit more expensive. So I had to bump it from $100 to $135, some of these models. And then, of course, for a much more upscale model, we charged $170, which I still think is a really great price point for a high-quality dress watch that, you know, that you're donating at the same time. So they're not incredibly, like, you know, expensive. We're not asking for $500, $600, $1,000, $1,500. It's basically, like, you know, around a couple hundred dollars.
Couple hundred dollars seems like a real deal. I mean, because you know, if you go into the mall, and I'm just gonna and I love Fossil watches, so don't get me wrong, Fossil fans. So I'm not picking on anybody.
Fossil is a great brand.
They're a great brand, but you go into the store, and you know their price point for anything is anywhere from $100 to $400 or $500, something like that. And nice watches, but you know you're just getting, you know, another watch. And if you're looking at like the Human Time Project type of a timepiece, you're getting an incredible timepiece that's stylish and it looks, you know, really hip and cool. All the cool kids are wearing it, but the price point on it is spectacular.
Yeah, what we were trying to bring in that medium point, because when you're pricing something as a company, it's very important that one strategic pricing, because if you make it too inexpensive, people consider it of lower quality. If you make it too expensive and people don't know the brand, people think, you know, you're charging too much for it. So trying to find the happy medium has been, like, you know, a very interesting point. So we figured between the 120 and the 170 range is a price point where people can still trust the brand, but at the same time, it wouldn't be that much of a exercise to try it out and see how they like, you know, the product.
Well, so let me ask you this from a business standpoint. Then you just talked about, you know, if it's too low, nobody wants to buy it because it's cheap, and if it's too expensive, oh my gosh, it's a Rolex, you know, we can't afford that. And so, what work did you and your team, you know, go put in? And if you don't want to tell me, that's okay too. But what did you put in from like a market research standpoint to kind of, you know, figure out that, you know, that 120 to 175 is really the niche that's going to work best for you?
Well, first of all, we are a very, very tiny company.
Well,
basically,
you know what I
mean. Me and a couple of interns here and there. And so I basically do my own market research because, I've been always a person who likes to read a lot. I subscribe to all the business magazines, Fast Company, Forbes, and all that. So I like to do some small research. And when I was doing stuff, the research online for consumers, my first inkling was, what was the impulse buy threshold? I mean, something that people say, hey, I like this, I'm going to get it because I don't care, and it's not that much money. So if it's a bad product or if it's a throwaway, I'll try it. And then back in 2003, that was around $100. So that's when we started with the project to be 98. Now, of course, everything has gotten a little bit more expensive, even though gas prices fluctuate here now, which hopefully it's very inexpensive right now in California, but it will go up later on. So the price point has kind of gone up. So I just did just basic market research, and what, you know, what the Pew Industrial Standards were saying, that what people are comfortable buying when they find something that they use as a gadget. And it also, that depends from the article. For example, for a clothing item, it's around $100. For a sneaker, it's around $150. For jewelry, it's around $200. For a phone, it's around $300, if it's not subsidized, of course. So there's different thresholds for like different items. So that's basically what we did. We did a really small market research, and of course, I got friends and family and started talking to people. And I actually went down one time to South Coast Plaza here in Orange County and started asking people, "What's the maximum you will pay for a watch that looks like this?" A couple of people thought I was crazy. A couple of just talked to me. A couple of people say it was a really nice watch. So I just kind of got a feel for it, you know. And it was very much an organic type of research. So it wasn't really that crazy strategy or Harvard Business School method.
Well, I think, you know, that's probably one of the smarter ways to go. You know, you get that real man on the street, you know, John Q. Public type of feel for what people are really looking for versus, you know, spending a ton of money on, you know, having somebody who's in a suit that never leaves a desk, who is so far removed from what's really going on in the world. You know, you just go out there and just say, hey, what would you pay for this? I think that's a really smart idea, a fun idea, too. So now you have a new watch that is out for, do we call it this season? And is it, it's called the Grand Mar?
Grand Mar, right, yes. It's actually, it's Latin for great sea, so it's mare. Grand Mare, but yeah.
I like that. That's how Grand Mare.
That's how you kind of pronounce it. And this is kind of like a small study that we were doing right now, because a lot of people ask, you know, hey, we love your watches, you know, but of course, you know, they're Japan designed and, you know, and Asia made and all this and that. They're good quality, but will you ever make a Swiss watch? And I say, you know what? That's a great idea, because it will totally elevate our perception of people of the quality really that we can bring, but the price points were just a little bit too high for us to try something like that. But luckily, with the advent of the Apple Watch, which is something that's going to basically revolutionize, a lot of people haven't really gotten into it yet, because I mean, it's a very early type of piece. It's a very early adopter type of thing. But I believe wearables is going to be a feature between now and the next 5 years. And everybody who has a watch between $300 and $500, a regular, normal watch, I think that company is really going to be in trouble. Because the level of technology you're going to be able to wear on your wrist is going to be amazing. So if you have a product that's under $300, you might be safe. But if you have a product in the watch category that's between $300 and $600, I think you're going to have a very hard time. Because once these models get better and more sophisticated and better in design, and it's going to be like a grand extension of your communications in daily life, and also gives you the time. So it's going to be kind of a situation.
So with the watches that you have today, you know, because they have a very, I call it a classic look, you know, but, you know, it doesn't have like the digital readout. It doesn't connect to your email. It doesn't, you know, get your car started 14 minutes before you're ready to go and get the air conditioning going. It doesn't do any of that. So you have a very classic style right now. Do you want to move in that direction where it's, you know, one of these readouts that orders your lunch for you before you're even hungry?
Well, actually, no, because the realm of the high technology company, I mean, like, you know, Apple, Samsung, all these great companies are going to do that much, much better than I am. And it's going to be like something that's going to be very interesting to follow. We will have an app for the Apple Watch next year, though. So it's something we will be in that terrain, but without having to, like, you know, engage into the hardware. But at the same time, we wanted to bring a Swiss timepiece that was a little bit more affordable. And because some of these companies in Switzerland are a little bit afraid of what might happen, we were able to bring down that huge price of the pedestal a little bit lower, that helped us, small companies like ours, to bring a Swiss watch into the market to a more affordable arena. So now, because I was going, when I did my market research for the Grand Mare, I was going to stores, Macy's, you know, Strand, you know, all these other, like, you know, high-end stores. And the least inexpensive Swiss-made watch right now retails for $450, $460. So I said, okay, so if I can come into the market for a Swiss-made watch at $360, go directly to the public with a donation, also a mission behind it, I think that would be kind of interesting. So what we decided to do is that let's go ahead and see how much people would, like, support this concept. And we started where we're right now with a crowdfunding effort with our Indiegogo campaign, in which we're producing the Grand Mare. But what we're doing right now is that we're offering people who want to, like, you know, get on board on the design, and 40% discount of the original price. So if you go ahead and pre-order one of these watches, you'll get a special price of 220, which basically is unheard of for a first watch right now. But at the same time, we think it's what we need to do now to get people excited about the product and also to get people excited about helping and donating. Yeah?
Well, number one, I want to talk about this in more detail. But what I want to do next is actually play a little bit of a commercial for one of our new, I don't know what we really call them. I'm going to call them a branding partner. It's called It Matters Radio. And they're a fun group of folks who I'm going to be doing one of their shows. They're going to have a couple of their authors on here in November. But we're going to play one of their spots. It's a little bit on the lengthy side, but it is fun. So I'm going to ask you to just sit back and relax. Maybe this is a time to take a quick bathroom break. You know, turn up the speaker real loud so you can still hear the commercial, or go get a refill on your cup of tea or something like that. And we'll be back in just a minute.
Welcome to our discussion of It Matters Radio. Our guest today is Angus McWilliams.
Hey, laddie, let's get on with this thing. I'm on my way to a birthday party for Nessie.
You're throwing a birthday party for the Loch Ness Monster?
Well, first of all, it's not a monster. And second of all, I'm talking about niece Nessie. She's a wee bit of a lovely lass.
I see. Well, okay. Angus, can you give us your thoughts on It Matters Radio?
Hey, wonderful people. They had me on a while back to talk about my book.
Your what?
My book. I wrote a book about the Adventures in Scotland.
Oh, I see. A book.
That's what I just said. What are you, a deaf man?
It Matters Radio focuses on discovering new talent and bringing important indie artists on the air. Monica, Kenneth, and Carrie offer up meaningful conversation on new music, books, and fun topics. It's unlike any other radio program known to man and woman alike.
You can say that again.
Known to man and woman alike.
Just because I said you can say it again doesn't mean you have to say it again.
I'm just doing my best to show everyone that It Matters Radio basically brings variety, fun, and entertainment with a sincere desire to discover new topics and talent.
Why didn't you just say that?
I just did.
Hey, Letty, remind me when I can listen.
It Matters Radio is on every Thursday night, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific.
You Americans with your different time zones. We only have one time zone in Scotland.
And that would be...
That would be the time to down a pint or two of ale.
It Matters Radio, for the best in conversation, music, books, and entertainment. Join us Thursday evenings at 9 Eastern, 6 Pacific. Discover the depth, diversity, meaningfulness, caring, guest-focused, friendly, enjoyable atmosphere of It Matters Radio with Ken, Monica, and Carrie.
That's a mouthful if I have a hard one.
Yes, and I'm going to go brush my teeth now. It Matters Radio.
When it comes to coffee, freshness is queen. That's why Rainbow Brew believes you should have the freshest coffee, roasted to order in small batches and delivered to your door within a couple days. Whether you're purchasing for a coffee shop, restaurant, or home, Rainbow Brew is your one-stop shop for fair trade and organic coffee. Offering many unique blends, including AM950's own Blue State blend. That's Rainbow Brew, the Queen Bean, a proud sponsor of the Morning Grind. Online at rainbowbrew.com. Brew something good today.
And that's our other sponsor of the day, Rainbow Brew out of Minneapolis, St. Paul. I tend to be a morning coffee drinker, which shocks a lot of people because that, you know, having such a calm and demure personality as I do, you wouldn't think that I ever have any caffeine in my diet, but that's about the time that I do. But Rainbow Brew, they're out of Minneapolis, St. Paul, and when I was approached by these guys, they're like, we have this great coffee. And I said, but you're in Minneapolis. Nobody grows coffee in Minneapolis. And they said, well, we do. You need to try this out. So they sent me some, and it's like, holy cow, this stuff is really good. So if you want some interesting flavors of coffee and you want to help a great small business, Rainbow Brew out of Minneapolis, St. Paul is at rainbowbrew.com. Go check them out. Tell them I sent you, and you can thank me with a great caffeine buzz a little bit later. They'll ground the beans for you and send it off same day, or they just send the beans, and then you can do it yourself, whatever you want to do. So it's awesome. Everybody, we're joined tonight by Gustavo Sainz. He is a movie maker. We're going to be talking to him about his movies in just a minute, but we're talking to him right now about the Human Time Project, which is a campaign that he's – well, it's a company that he runs that helps – bring watches and timepieces to medical personnel in countries that need it. And he's got a great Indiegogo campaign right now. We've just started talking about it right before the break. And the watch that he has is a Grand Mare. Did I say that right?
Well said.
There we go. Swiss watch, and that helps others. I've got a link on the show page, so if you want to go check it out, you can do that. If you are listening on the YouTube replay, it again, just look, go to Indiegogo.com and look for the Grand Mare Swiss Watch That Helps Others campaign, and you will see that there. Now, you talked about the one watch that you get a super, super deal on for $220, but you've also got two others. One's a stainless steel and one's a Christmas pack, Gustavo. What's the difference in the price points, and who would be perfect targets for those for gift giving this holiday season?
Well, the packages are just the introductory models. One comes with a black rubber silicone strap, so it's very great for outdoor adventures and basically water sports. The other one comes with a solid stainless steel strap, so it's more of a elegant timepiece. You can kind of wear it everywhere, so you can have it on the night of the town, but you can also go sailing with it or even scuba diving with it. And one of the reasons that we chose this type of design was because what are the most commonly used designs of people who have active lifestyles? It's either a diver-style watch or a chronograph-style watch. So what we did is that we combined both of those styles into one watch and made it more of a nautical type of a style watch. It's something that works great for surfing. It works great, like, in for sailing. You can scuba with it. You can have, like, all type of it. But at the same time, you can still go out on the town on a nice date, on a nice party venue, you know, business meeting, and still have something that's very elegant and fashionable, and at the same time, while helping others. But the differences between the packages are mostly that it's just different style, and the Christmas pack is something that we added because some people like to have this watch because they're watch collectors in the fans, but also they want to give out another one as a present. So what we're doing is I'm just making it so easy and affordable for them to have two packages at the same time. So it's like, you know, the more you buy it, the lower the price goes. So that's kind of behind that.
Okay, so for the Christmas pack, you get two watches. Does that mean that with a Christmas pack, you're giving away two watches also?
Yeah, exactly. Every single time you buy or pre-order a Grand Mare, another watch will be donated. So that's kind of like the whole premise, you know, behind it. So.
Well, then that's what we need to push. Everybody needs to go get the Christmas pack and, you know, support that. Yeah, because, you know,
If you do buy just one watch, that watch also donates. So every single, even if you just get the regular single strap, the stainless steel or the package, every single watch you buy, it creates a donation. So that's kind of like the whole trigger.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's the whole,
and one,
you know, the whole thing is get one of them, but, you know, but you have to get at least one, you know, to do that. And I think that you'll be in good shape there.
Right.
So from a styling standpoint here, Gustavo, how did you decide that you wanted to have like the black wristband? And then for like the dial, you have the, you know, the red portion of, counterbalance with the black. It looks almost like a poker chip.
Well, actually, that was kind of part of the designs that we were looking for on the diver style watch. One of the things that I was doing for research was, like, you know, of the mechanisms and the factory that I'm working with in Switzerland and the styles that they had. And one of the situations that I've noticed is that this model doesn't have a movable bezel. It's fixed because by research, 90% of the people don't even use a bezel, even when they're diving. And second point is that the movable bezel, with time, starts creating micro leaks into the movement. So a watch that probably should be water resistant for like 15, 20 years, probably like will be water resistant 5, 6, 7 years, and then you have to take it in and repair it. And that's one of the greatest misconceptions that people have about these luxury watches. When you buy a Rolex or Breitling, you know, whatever, you have to maintain them like a sports car because that's what they are. They are tiny little sports cars for your wrist. So you need to have a proper working Rolex, you have to clean it almost every year or year and a half. The same with some of these movements. So most people think that you buy a great watch and it's done. No, you have to keep up them to have the proper use to them. So I figure, well, if I can give them something that basically has no zero maintenance and they can kind of use every day at a great price point, I think, well, we might have something to it. And we decided to do, like, you know, the 15-minute marker. That's kind of like, you know, the style when you go using a diver watch. And I thought a little bit of color kind of helped, you know, balance the contrast of the logo. Exactly. It kind of brings out a little bit of more, it makes it more stylish, a little bit different. And some people say, like, you know, they kind of enjoy it because it kind of reminds them of the Rolex GMT minus the $5,600.
Well, if you want to spend that $5,600, that's fine. Where's my calculator? I'll just figure out how many watches of yours that we can buy for $5,600, and we'll solve that one, right? I guess you need three people to do that, and your whole campaign's taken care of. So
exactly. No, and one of the things that we just wanted to point out there that the campaign is right now just started out because, of course, like we only have like, you know, very few movement in because, of course, it's just started a couple of days ago and we have another 26 more days to go. And then, of course, we have more publicity coming in through the bigger blogs and other like other people are helping us because when most people talk about crowdfunding, they really don't know that only less than 30% of all the Kickstarters, of all the Indiegogos ever get funded because the problem is that there's a whole adage that says you need money to make money. And most of these campaigns who are successful, they have a lot of money behind it with that, with publicity or a lot of great contacts through the media outlets that gets that exposure. So at the same time, we're figuring, okay, well, if we're going to have to spend like $2,000 or $3,000 on the campaign, it beats the purpose. We just basically flung the launch ourselves. So we were trying to get our word out there and, you know, through the kindness of people's hearts, see if people can spread the word, get our word out there and just kind of build it a little bit organically. And at the same time, if the project doesn't lift off the ground and then the funding is reached, we are still a privately held company in which we have our own, like, you know, our own capital. So this is a more of an experiment to see if the market was wanting this type of model. And if there's enough interest, even though we might not reach the goal, we might be able to still chip in and have produced it. We just wanted to see, like, you know, if people were interested, first of all. And then after that, we can kind of take care of it. Because most people say, okay, well, you know what? They're asking for $15,000, $18,000. They only got $7,000. They're not going to make it. No, that's not the case. We want to see if there's interest. We just need a little boost from the people to see, you know, how is it going out there. Of course, if only two or three people order it and not many people are really enthusiastic about it, it means, well, something failed. Either the design didn't catch up or we weren't exposed to that many people, but that's, you know, the nature of business. So, you know, you have to take, you know, the good with the bad. So at the same time, you know, we like to help ask people to go out there and encourage themselves. And of course, if the campaign doesn't get funded, all monies are refunded anyway. So it's kind of like, you know, a little bit of a support group to say, okay, well, you know, we like what we're doing. Let's see how we can help a little bit more.
I think that is so smart because, you know, one of the things that I think is really telling is that, you know, everybody wants to go do their crowdfunding thing, but they don't realize the amount of work that's involved to make the campaign successful. It's a lot of work. And like you said,
a lot of people,
it's the money.
But also when people think that creating a company is just getting funding, but there's so much more. You have to go there and then manufacture. You have to make sure that these manufacturers are able to deliver things on time. You have to make sure that all these different situations are happening. You're going to have we've been in the market almost like 2 years and a half, almost three. We've got brought in 5 watches to the market. So every single hiccup that you can think of, we've had. We've had basically straps from the wrong color right from the factory. Lumos, you know, that glow-in-the-dark type of paint, not sticking properly to the thing. There's a lot of things that happen that you have to evolve and overcome and learn from the situation. So when these people, like what happened with the Pebble watch, it was a huge success, but then, like, you know, only 20% of people got their watches. A lot of people didn't get them. There was a big, like, you know, brouhaha about the whole situation and kind of clouded over the whole crowdfunding thing. It's not that these people were bad intention. The problem is that they didn't know the realities of outsourcing, you know? So.
Well, I think it's, I learn something new when we visit every single time, and I'm grateful for the work that you're doing here. Everybody, go check out the Indiegogo campaign for the Grand Mare watch, and if you want one or two or five, you know, help, I always say help a brother out, but help make this happen.
Thank you. And also, people, I know that sometimes the URL is a little bit more complicated, so people can go also directly to our website, which is humantimeproject, just like it sounds, .com, humantimeproject.com. And they can go directly onto the landing page here, and that can redirect them also to the Indiegogo or to our other models that we have. We have our Centurion model, which is a very classic Roman numeral watch, which is very popular right now. And it's also limited edition. We only made 100 of those, and there's still some of those available. And then we have another one that we did for all of our fans of water in the Navy called the Naval Raider, which is a little homage to our, all of our Navy friends. That's also right now available. That watch starts at $135. So just going to humantimeproject.com can get all the information you need.
And I like on the Naval Raider that you've got like the skull and like the swords for like the pirates out there. I want to call it the I Matey watch, but I like Naval Raider. That's really cool, too. So, yeah, again, if you want to go and check it out, thehumantimeproject.com is the place to go see. You can see all of the different things that they have going on there and, you know, help support the cause here. Well, we got about, 10, 15 minutes left here, Gustavo, and I've been dying to talk to you about movie making and what's been going on in your world behind the camera. So, catch us up to date. What's been going on? The last time that we talked, you were like either finishing up one movie and going into like post-production, but it's been a hot minute. So what's been going on in your world there?
Well, actually, we're very happy to say that our movie that we started, we directed with a good friend of mine, Eric Hensman, here from Orange County, from Lennox Productions. We are about to finalize all production on the movie, and right now, The Prey is in current post-production. We hope to have the movie finished by the end of the year, in which we're going to have to take it to a couple of test audiences here and there. And also, we will be having some very exciting news probably by the end of the year, since we're going to some important meetings with some big distributors and a couple of studios. So I can't really talk too much about that yet, because usually like these meetings are kind of like, you know, what kind of determines. But actually, the movie will probably be available for the viewing public sometime around next year. So we're really excited about that movie.
So what is it like being an independent filmmaker in Hollywood today when you're, you know, really having to wear so many different hats? I mean, how many hats did you wear on this production?
On this production, I was writer, producer. I probably a couple of times took care of the catering. I was also armorer, because sometimes, you know, it's a little bit complicated on the situation being in a war movie. I was the only person that was had a little bit of expertise in firearms. So it was kind of a very interesting situation, but it takes an enormous village to make a movie and to make a movie good. If people say movie making is hard, no, they have no idea. It is extremely hard. And that's why a lot of people just stick to novels or stick to writing or kind of stuff. Because making a movie, it's incredibly hard. Anybody who finishes a movie, I applaud them. And if they happen to make a good movie, even 10 times more kudos, because it is so difficult. But at one point, we had close to 150 people on set. That's included above the line and below the line. And we are a very small production, but at the same time, it took us so many friends, so many favors, so many situations that if people would try to replicate what we did, I think it's kind of impossible, because we did a lot of things that were in-house. The monster was created in-house. If, for people who don't know what The Prey is, it's really quickly, it's basically Predator in Afghanistan. It's a bunch of soldiers that get trapped in a cave in Afghanistan, and they're hunted down by this monster in the cave. So that's kind of all you need to know. Black Hawk Down meets Predator. That's about it.
Well, and I saw some of the footage. You were very proud of the fact that you had, you know, some footage that you were sharing with me on your iPad, or your, I think it was your iPad, or maybe it was your laptop.
Yes.
And I was like, holy cow, here's this indie filmmaker, and he's showing me something that looks like it's off of this big budget, you know, major motion picture studio type of scenario. And this is just something that, you know, he's put together here. And I was very impressed with you from the first moment that I had the chance to shake your hand. And then to see that type of footage come out of your iPad, I thought was just absolutely brilliant. So I think that
Thank you very much, Garrett. Yeah. Well, the thing also is that I was able to connect with really great, talented filmmakers. And my two partners in this venture, the Hensman brothers, Eric and Matt Hensman, which is a name people are going to see a lot in the next coming years. These guys are absolutely fantastic. I mean, they're at the level probably even better than the Wachowski brothers. I mean, these guys they live and breathe action fantasy. These guys are the comic book guys. They're like the followers of all these, like, you know, like basically fantasy type storylines. They go to Comic-Con every year, but also they're extremely talented artists. Matt is an incredible sculptor, artist, and director, and Eric's an incredible, like, you know, storyteller and director. I mean, like, you know, we're watching sometimes some of this footage on this image, and for me, the scene is fine, and the guy said, no, wait a second, he changed his eye line 2 seconds ago, and he twitched too much. I said, what? I didn't see anything, Eric, but he was there. The thing is that we put so much passion and love into this one project that we wanted to make as good as possible, because when we're having these meetings in the next couple of months, if you get the lucky chance to be in front of a studio executive or a person of a high ranking, which has seen absolutely everything under the sun, you only have 5 minutes to impress them, you know? So you have to be not on your A game, on your triple A game. So well, we wanted to make sure that this movie wasn't a smaller B type movie, even though it has Danny Trejo, like, which is kind of like, you know, one of these characters with, like, it's very widely loved, but most of the time he's in movies that are, like, you know, are on the lower budget. So we wanted to make sure that our movie standed out because we had a very well produced monster, a great ensemble cast, and great acting that follows the storyline. We have Nick Schindler, who's probably one of the best character actors out there. I mean, he was in, like, you know, Tears of the Sun and Chronicles of Riddick and Con Air. The guy basically carries the whole movie, and he has such charisma as one of, like, the bad mercenaries who are kind of trapped in the cave with these younger soldiers, kind of like, you know, making things happen in there. So it's part of the passion of everybody that got involved that, you know, we want to make something that when people see this, wow, okay, this movie, we want to see, you know, create that reaction the first time you see the footage, you know.
And so how many projects do you work on at one time without kind of like absolutely going crazy? Because, you know, because you can't just work on one, because then you have all of your eggs in one basket. And as fun as that is to have just a single thing that is going on, you just really can't do that. So how many things do you get to work on and remain relatively sane and in control?
Well, Human Time Project is kind of like my little passion pit. That's kind of like, you know, my company that I really love because I love watches and I love the whole purpose behind it. So that's something that even though movie making takes off and becomes like, you know, my principal career, I will always maintain Human Time Project because I still believe that we can do good, you know, in the world. So that's something I want to keep. But also at the same time, we're in post-production for this movie. I have another script that I'm just about to get some proper funding for the green lighting called The Young Washington Chronicles, which is probably going to start shooting sometime next year in Canada. And it's basically America's first X-Files with a young George Washington.
So, I love that.
Yeah. So it's kind of like the whole concept, you know, we got to brought the whole thing back to the front. We have a very young George Washington who's set into the middle of the woods in the frontier of Canada. There's some sort of thing that's killing down people. We don't know what's going on. We send him to investigate, and he opens up a whole can of worm of, you know, of, like, you know, fantasy things and, you know, extraprovincial things, Mason Brotherhood, you know, all these fantasy elements are kind of like, you know, bringing around. So that's, you know, that's one of the major storylines that I'm working on right now and that's about to be produced. And, of course, a couple of ideas that we're keeping around there at Lennox Productions also because, you know, once we have the big meetings, okay, say, we love The Prey, but what else you got, they say. So
right.
We have a couple other storylines that we're working on right now. But right now they're just basic treatments and we're not going too far into it because, of course, we have to finish up The Prey and present it as good as possible.
So when you'd mentioned that, you know, you have just gone through or are getting ready to go through getting funding to get your projects going. How does that work? I would love to understand that process a whole lot more so I can raise $10 million to do my next album or something like
well,
that.
Actually, you only have two ways of going around, okay? Either you have private money or you get studio production money. Studio production money doesn't exist unless you have the rights to a big comic book franchise. You have a huge star, say a Brad Pitt, a Tom Hanks, say a Tom Cruise behind your project or something of the sort, or you're just kind of very well-known quirky director like Tarantino says, listen, I want to do a phone book, and they say yes. You know? So if you're not have one of those huge, huge elements, there is no way you're getting funding from a studio. Then the second part is just the private financiers. So what you have to do is understand what the marketplace is, and everybody, absolutely everybody, Garrett, is chasing money right now. I don't know if you're familiar with that one movie that came out last year called Rush, about the Formula One driver.
Yeah.
It was directed and produced by Ron Howard, one of the top guys, you know, in the movie-making world. He went to every single studio in America on this project. Everybody said no. He had to go to Europe and get private funding to get that movie made. And it became
crazy.
Success. But the problem is that if you put yourself in the position of a studio executive, it's very simple. I mean, like, you know, you don't want to risk, you know, your job over a movie that doesn't do any good, that doesn't make well. So what are you going to do? Are you going to basically blow away your $2, $3 million salary for to try to do art? No, they do Transformers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 11, 12. They do Avengers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 12. They do Star Wars 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then do more spin-offs of that. So out of their logic, you know, they have to play it safe because they have all these different pressures that we don't know about. So the real artistry is left to us smaller independent producers to come up with something that's kind of fun, original, and they can kind of create some sort of profit. And then when you make somebody else's money, that's when you actually get to go into Hollywood, not before that. There's a lot of people that go to film school, and they're extremely talented people that spend a lot of money, but then they're wondering why are they just doing photocopies at Universal for scripts. It's because nobody's going to give them the risk of $5 or $6 million for a person who hasn't done anything before to create some sort of something that will create a return. It's a huge risk.
I totally get that. You know, I mean, so part of my question is a little on the rhetorical side, but at the same time, it's like, you know, what the heck do you sit there and do at your studio besides take really expensive lunches and overpay, you know, meetings and vacations and things that you do when all you're doing is producing Transformers 1 through 12, you know, Friday the 13th, 1 through 56, you know, and you're not doing anything that's original or, you know, creative. And I get that there's a risk behind it, you know, but, you know, isn't that part of, you know, the movie studio's responsibility to, you know, give us, you know, entertainment that is, you know, outside of that too? So for every Transformer that you do, shouldn't it be like the Human Time Project? It should be the Human Movie Project where, you know, you put out one, and I won't say piece of crap because I like the Transformers movies, but you put out that big mega monster thing. And then you have to do like a regular film as well. And, you know, and I love your insight on this, but explain to me how a movie like Transformers, which makes like $1 billion globally, you know, will come back and they'll say, oh, we barely made any money on this movie. I just don't know how we're even going to be able to keep the doors open another day. You know, it's like how they adjust their books and cook their books to make it sound like all these movies do so horribly. When you have video on demand, you still have DVDs that are out there that people are buying, I don't know why. You still have ticket sales and you still have all that other stuff. You know, what's going on that's preventing them from, you know, making movies with people like you?
Well, it's very easy. You got to remember that it's called show business, you know. And right now, the people who are really artists, who people who really enjoy the art of movie making, are long gone. We no longer have, the Warner Brothers, you know, Metro Golden Mayer. I mean, like all these great, like, you know, producers that we had before, like, you know, Darren Zuckerberg and all those people who were passionate and love storytelling. We have large corporations who mission is to make money. And these are the people who are running some of these studios. Some of these people who are in the studio level come from marketing, and they're brilliant people. They really understand what they're doing. And what are they supposed to be doing? Making more money. So they're just being intelligent. And there are a lot of people who want to make great stories inside these movie studios. I mean, the thing is that they have to find the proper way to how you can mesh creativity with business. And that's one of the things that we did with the first thing we started with Eric is, listen, let's not go on extremes. Let's make a movie that is fun, entertaining, but very, very commercial, because it is show business. People, I mean, we have private investors in which we have to the obligation to make the money, you know. So we can't go out there and do like a soapy like melodrama about like an orphan to World War II, because it's not going to make any money, you know. So, and how are you going to finance your second movie? I mean, you have to make Jaws before you can make Schindler's List, and that's the rule per se, you know. So there are people who do want to do great stuff, but the problem is that there also is a lot of pressure to create a lot of balances. And also, not a lot of movies make money. Some of them make money, some of them don't. But at the same time, it kind of balances out, because, I mean, when you make like close to $1 billion of Transformer and a couple other movies that make good money, that's totally, you know, understandable. And like, for example, right now, the Man from U.N.C.L.E. was directed by Guy Ritchie. Great movie, really interesting, but just didn't really hit that mark. And they probably spent probably close to $100 million, you know, on that movie, plus another 50 or 30 to advertising.
Because, you know, I remember hearing a little bit about The Man from U.N.C.L.E., and we could, you know, I could have you on for another 12 hours, and we'd talk about the movies all day long. But, you know, using that example, though, you know, quite frankly, I just didn't hear a whole lot about The Man from U.N.C.L.E., and it was in and out of the theaters in about 6 seconds.
And that's another problem that you have right now. There is so much competition for eyeballs. You have kids who go to the movies, they're looking at stuff at their screens on their iPhones and iPads or devices. They're on video games. They're on the internet. They're all these different. So right now, it's very, very scattered to get, like, you know, certain attention. So if your movie doesn't hit big the first week, you're gone. You are absolutely gone, and it's complicated. And then you have video on demand, you have this other thing, but also the biggest problem comes back to because technology is going to evolve, and we're probably going to, like, you know, probably 100 years from now, we'll be watching, like, you know, movies from our palm of our hand projected directly to our brain through some sort of device or some sort of glass. But at the same time, you're still going to need marketing dollars for people to know about the product. And that's right now what is happening in the situation, that you still need marketing dollars for people to know that exists on video on demand, to know that exists on the internet. But it always comes down to that one type of circle, you know. How can you make your movie as cost effective as possible so when you put in a lot of money, it will bring back a return, you know, in the advertising.
There we go. There we go. Gustavo, I'm going to ask you to give us like your closing thought of the night on anything that you want to talk about or anybody you want to say hello to. And then we're going to close out the show with my new song called Witch Sisters Halloween. You can see the video on YouTube right now. It's sure to scare you incredibly beyond anything you've ever seen before. But Gustavo, last words of the night.
Well, first of all, thank you very much, Garrett, for having me over.
You're so welcome.
I'd like to thank the people who are listening us over. So if you're interested in our project, please go out and check out humantimeproject.com. And to everybody who's listening out there, I don't think I'm that wise or old to get anybody a good farewell. But just tomorrow when you wake up, smile, and think, you know, what can I do to make somebody's day? And just, you know, just bring a little bit more good to the world, because that's basically all we need.
I love it. Everybody, go support Gustavo Sainz, his company is the Human Time Project, humantimeproject.com. Go check it out and tell your friends that they can do the world a lot of good this holiday season by supporting that project. Enjoy Witch Sisters Halloween. We'll see you tomorrow night with the Sydney Surfer. Mr. Mark DePina comes back. I say that, but he's got the flu, and he's been instant messaging me for the last couple of days. So if he's not back tomorrow, I've got other plans in store for you. But Mark will be here tomorrow night to talk poetry. Down under. We'll see you then. Have a great night.
What do we have here?
Met three sisters on the beach alone that Friday night. Gathered near a campfire kiln, their fire burned so bright. They each got up and took their turn, looking me up and down. Can we trust him? And we tell him they would circle round. The harvest moon above was full, but showed their scary smiles. Come sit with us, the three agreed, you'll want to stay a while.
This Halloween is full of tricks.
glamour, beauty,
hags,
old tricks, and jinxes mad, enchanting. Their cackles high into the night, they swept into the sky. They said, return next Halloween, the kitsch will reignite.
Been listening to Rated G Radio.